back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Good news and bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Mars. See, a United States astral robot becomes a creature of death.
And babes.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain. Back to the House of Pain.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast. From classic cults and all the cheese in between, the movies are babe, the entertainment is grade A, and I am your host, Mr. Jason Giaconetti, and I am joined by my dad, Mr. Al Giaconetti.
Good morning, Jay. I guess today we're doing The Land Unknown, the black and white, I wouldn't say it's a lost movie, but it's one that you really haven't seen too often from 1957.
Yeah, and we'll get to it right after this.
In 1947, the Byrd expedition to the South Pole reported a warm water oasis deep inside the icy Antarctic. This is the story of another expedition and of what might be found, what might happen today in that remote, unexplored last frontier on Earth. Unchanged since prehistoric times, the land unknown. Could man have survived in the dinosaur age of mighty monsters? Shudder at history's most ferocious killer, Tyrannosaurus Rex. The battle of the great Stegosauri. Huge carnivorous man-eating plants. The incredible water monster, Elasmosaurus.
We'll never get out of here, Alan. Never.
Stop it, do you hear me? Stop it. This doesn't sound like you. We're not lit yet.
That's how I rule.
Where's the wreck? Talk.
You're gonna rot here.
The Land Unknown was released October 30th, 1957, was distributed by Universal International with a running time of 78 minutes. The director was Virgil W. Vulgar. Now, originally, the director was Jack Arnold. And what happened was they were going to shoot this with a really big production, shoot it in color. And it was all supposed to be an A picture. They thought this was going to be a big time, and it had a different cast in mind and a lot of stuff. And what happened was, supposedly, according to William Reynolds, the studio spent so much money on the mechanical dinosaur that they couldn't afford to shoot other things. So they said, all right, we already spent the money on the dinosaur. They cut the rest of the budget. They changed out the director because Vulgar was on. He was a contract director for them. And they also decided to, once that happened, that's when Jack Arnold said, "I'm out." And they took it from a B picture to down to a B picture. And that's why it's in black and white. So, of course, your producer was William Arnold. Okay, your writers are Charles Palmer, William Robson, and Laszlo Gorig. And it's starring Jack Mahoney, Shirley Patterson, and Henry Brandon. Music by Henry Mancini, right? It's a name we hear later on, obviously. Yeah, you know?
Mancini.
And I have Hans Salter, and I have Herman Stein as the people who contributed music to the movie.
Wow. Okay. It's the music that, I mean, it was George Gershenson. He's a noted composer and a familiar name on a lot of pictures that you see.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going by what I found. I found that, I mean, again, they might not have contributed much, but that's what it was listed as. I found it. Anyway. All right. So our story opens as a small crew led by Commander Harold Roberts and reporter Maggie Hathaway are on an expedition into Antarctica for the United States Navy. During a helicopter flight, they are called back to their ship via radio because of an unexpected storm approaching. At first, they try to fly around the storm, but low on fuel, they fly into the storm where they almost collide in midair with a man-sized predator, which is just a pterodactyl.
You mean Rodan?
Yeah, well, it wasn't Rodan. No, Rodan is huge. Yeah. This is small.
Yeah, but it looked like Rodan.
Yeah, but no, it didn't look like Rodan. Rodan is huge.
Small. No, not up in the close-up. It looked like Rodan because of the long shot. When you watch, okay, when you watch
it's
Rodan.
Like, it's a thing on a wire. Rodan is not a thing on a wire. It's a guy in a suit. Anyway, their rotor breaks and they're unable to stay in the air as they start to descend. They are surprised when they end up landing well below, like 3,000 feet below sea level, in a warm volcanic crater. Inside, they discover a steamy jungle populated by living dinosaurs, giant flesh-eating plants, and fresh human footprints.
Right. Where they land, it was called Hell's Chimney.
Yes, yeah. The crew encounter many dangers and perils in the jungle in their fight for survival. So, they meet the crew meet Hunter. Hunter is he looks like a caveman, but he is from the 1947 expedition. He was lost. And he's living amongst that in the land unknown, right? He's the lone survivor of the plane crash from the 47 expedition, which is why they even know that there's any warm water. Now, that reference to the 47 expedition is actually in reference to, inspired by, I should say, the discovery in 1947 of an area of inexplicably warm water in Antarctica. They refer to that. You know, that actual thing. And again, there's lots of stock footage of Navy ships breaking through ice, and there's stock footage or whatever. It's funny when they go from stock footage to them, like, clearly on a stage, standing on a balcony, and then stock footage. But that's what you did back then.
Yeah, but, I mean, the stock footage, really, in the beginning of the movie, the first 5-10 minutes of it is a lot of stock footage, and the music and the stock footage enhances the storyline, and I thought it was effective. I mean, sometimes you get stock footage and it's obvious that it doesn't belong, but this time it does.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying it doesn't. I'm just saying, but it's you can kind of tell the difference when you get there. Anyway, so he has learned to survive in this land with the aid of a conch that drives off the animals and by raiding the dinosaur's nest, and he's breaking open all the eggs. He has the egg hammer. He doesn't call it that, but that's what it should be called. He offers to remain the reins of his airplane to repair the helicopter, but only if the crew leaves Maggie with him, right? So, and that's the trading three lives for one. It's kind of a theme that goes throughout there. The crew refuses, but they also know that after 25 days, their ship will have left the Antarctic as winter sets in. Unsuccessful in finding the remains of the plane hidden by Hunter, the crew debate leaving Maggie or forcing the information out of Hunter by torture. Commander Roberts refuses to sink to either low. Maggie is later attacked by the Elasmosaur with its rowboat arms action, which is because the best is the flipper you see isn't touching the water. It just is up cranking through the air and cranking. So it's definitely like just being a row.
Well, that's the creature that they spent the money on. The mechanical, he's been hit. That's a mechanical thing.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Really in water.
Yeah. Well, no, the T-Rex has headlights, Dad. So, but Hunter rescues her. All right, so, and that's when he throws, and if you count it, he has two spears lit on the boat. How many spears does he throw? Three. Yep.
I didn't notice that.
You know why?
Good.
Because they did the same scene twice.
Right.
Where he throws the first spear, and it bites it, and it goes out. They do that scene, they show that scene immediately again. And I'm like, well, come on. Like, you know, I mean, like, I've seen this movie bunches of times, and I don't ever think about it being like, oh, now I'm watching it, like, thinking about, like, that's the exact same scene. But that's not unheard of, because when he throws the second one, when he finally gets it to force it underwater, it's a different effect shot. So, but, again, you know, you only have so many times you can throw lit things on a set and not catch everything on fire. After the fight and learning that the crew refuses to torture him, well, that's the funny, because the one guy wants to kill him. And they're fighting in there, and he has them with the... He's going to burn them alive. And they swim. Now, they know there's an elasmosaur, but the colonel and the other guy swim across the lake and go to where he is.
The cave.
Yeah, Hunter gives him the map to location. What does he say? We've walked past this thing like 20 times! And I'm like, oh, boy. The Navy's not looking good in this one. So, I mean, it's not Navy versus the Night Monster bad, but hey. After repairing the helicopter, they take off in a hurry as a Tyrannosaurus Rex attacks them. They fly to pick up Maggie, who is with Hunter at the time. Hunter is ambushed by the same elasmosaur that leaps out of the water, an attempt to leap out of the water, and the crew comes to his rescue. They fly out of the Lost World with Hunter and Maggie in tow. Once clear of the crater, they are able to radio their ship, and they're guided in. They're fuel exhausted. Their helicopter crashes into the water ocean before getting to the ship. They are rescued. They're brought aboard. That's when Maggie and Harold have their little exchange, where Maggie now is having children with him, and this guy no-sells the heck out of it. But that scene where the helicopter misses the boat, it's a very famous scene.
Yeah, and it's real.
Yeah, it's real, yeah. Right. But I love when it misses, it kind of, because you can tell, I mean, it's real, because it was a movie. Everyone's like, oh no, run! Like, it's the Navy. They're like, okay, let's go get this. Like, it's reaction of real people. It's not, like, movie reactions. Like, oh no, let's save them. Movie reaction. It was like, and there it goes. So.
Yeah, the one thing about, well, any of the scenes with the helicopters, whether they were, you know, stock footage, like that last scene, they did match the helicopters up.
Oh, yeah.
And the one thing that I noticed is that the number on the helicopter that goes down in the sea is the same number on the helicopter in any of the process shots. Yeah. So that was pretty good.
Yeah, well, again, little continuity like that, that's important. So, we've talked about this, the dinosaurs in this, Tyrannosaurus Rex, the T-Rex in this movie, has headlights for eyes, which is true. When you see it, his eyes are glowing, and I think they were trying to make it look more menacing and stuff, which is great, but they are clearly headlights. And the Tyrannosaurus head from this movie actually became a spot from under the stairs from the monsters.
Yes.
They used that head because, again, they had it laying around, and, you know. Funny thing, I'm sure you have this, the Dell 4 color. It was issue number 845, August 1957. I'm sure you have this.
Yes.
Downstairs for the comic book reader out there. Real quick, I don't know if you noticed this. In the beginning of the movie, Lieutenant Carman is wearing the aviation green uniform. It's black and white, but you can clearly tell he's not wearing blue. He's wearing the aviation green. This uniform was the naval aviation personnel from 1925 until 2011, but was rarely seen due to restrictions put on it by senior commanders and naval regulations. They didn't want that in movies. They wanted everyone wearing the same colors in movies. So later, I mean, I can't remember any movie ever where someone from the Navy's wearing a green uniform. Yeah. But he clearly is not wearing blue. They're wearing blue, and then he's wearing, which is green. Again, you can tell because, it's not the same color. It's clearly lighter, but that's what that is. So that was rare. So that actually would be correct because he's the aviation officer. He's wearing this is, I think, what speaks to the A picture beginnings,
right. Yes.
But the B movie results. You have the right uniform. You have the AV. You have the number on the side of the helicopter. You have all the little things that an A picture would have because they have somebody probably checking those things. In a B picture, it's the old, a Corman shoot and get away.
Right.
Or Luke would say, light and get away kind of thing. That's what they would do. Why shoot it twice? I don't have money for twice. We have money for once. And the scenes the thing is, yes, there would have been different actors. If you would have had an A-picture budget, they would have had whatever would have been in color. But in color, that would have been really important to have the green aviation thing compared to the blue one that everyone else is wearing. Like, those are little things that you catch when you have a movie that starts out as an A-picture and goes into a B-picture. We had said this, I think, on the end of the Hardware episode. This was a movie that, man, we are not big fans of remakes. But I've never understood why this has never been remade.
Oh, yeah.
We have movies like... And I thought about this. The movie that basically remade this was The Land That Time Forgot. Doug McClure. With the submarine. And I don't know if that's an upgrade or kind of a step sideways.
That was pretty good.
The dinosaurs are not that. It's a step sideways. That's what I'm saying. It's like we made a movie the same, you know, kind of thing. I mean, it gets worse. I mean, it's not the people that time forgot. Goes downhill from there. But I'm saying is that's the only movie I'm thinking of where it's basically the exact same story because they're in the ocean. They go through a tunnel. All right, but we need to get back to this movie instead of that movie. So. Right. You were mentioning something about we talked about Steve, who's the guy who the aviation officer who's wearing the green kind of thing, and then they crash and they're going to fix the plane.
Right. Well, the helicopter, that's the up down bar is bent, and so he says, well, we can't take off with this thing being bent, and they don't have a spare part.
Right.
So he takes it off the rotor. And he brings it down, and sure enough, it looks like, if you break your finger, it's bent pretty good. So he's a man of my own heart. If you can't fix it with a hammer, you can't fix it.
Well, how else are they supposed to fix it?
Well, no, but between him and Jock Mahoney, the commander, they could try to pull it. But because it's made of titanium, you can't use a hammer on titanium.
All right, so we've mentioned that the Elasmosaur was clearly mechanical with its rotating flipper there. The face was nothing spectacular. The teeth kind of are weird. They kind of bend out at weird angles.
Yeah.
Which is weird because they spent a lot of money on this thing. This is where the money went to. And I figured at least one of the dinosaurs would look better. The T-Rex looks way better than the Elasmosaur. And the T-Rex is a guy in a suit. It does. I mean, at least his mouth opens up and down.
That's your opinion. I thought the Plesiosaur, it's an actual model. It's in the water. It's not too bad.
The head's really bad.
It looks a little like the giant claw without the tufts of hair. Because on the giant claw, his teeth are sticking out every which way.
That's an alien. This is something we know what they look like. They have bones. The teeth on an Elasmosaur do not curl out like an Arabian Nights sword.
No, I understand.
Okay, but if it did, it couldn't eat anything. It would be stabbing itself in the face. So anyway, the man-eating plant, that's another famous part of this. When she backs into it, which is awesome. They use that actually on the cover of one of the DVD set that you can purchase this through. It's on the cover of the DVD set for the sci-fi thing, and it's her in the giant plant. Again, that's nothing special either. That's just them working wires on the plant.
Yeah, that was the man-eating plant. That happens about 20 minutes in. Yeah. It looks a little like the crawling eye without the eye.
The same effect. It's just tentacles and stuff. So, but yeah, I mean, and the T-Rex, it's funny because it has headlights for eyes and whatever. It's just fine. I mean, the T-Rex, it's funny because the T-Rex actually looks a lot like the T-Rex from Land of Time Forgot because their mouths open way too far. Yeah. They don't just open. Like, its head flops back and comes forward and back. What? It's like a little kid working on like a puppet, you know?
Exactly. Man, when I first saw the first sighting of T-Rex. And again, when I first saw this movie in 1957, I'm a young guy. This is one of the first few times that we've gone to the movies by ourselves with my brother and I. But the first time I saw this T-Rex, it's a man in a suit. I said, well, it looks pretty good. Again, at this point, I hadn't even seen King Kong.
Right, yeah.
So, but when I watched this time, I said, this makes Godzilla look real.
Yeah, well, because they spend a lot more money on those suits, too. So
yeah, I mean, the folds in the skin.
Yes,
I mean, you could actually walk faster than this thing to get away from
it. The funny part about this is, obviously, my daughter watched this movie. We watched it on Svengoolie, and she finds this funny. She thinks it's like, she likes these kind of things. She likes watching movies with Dad. My dad has a model kit. The only model kit I even know of that exists for this has the scene-ish of them in the water with the Elasmosaur and the T-Rex. It has everything going on.
And it's a great-looking model.
It's got a big base to it, too.
And when it's finished, I mean, it really is. It does capture, because the model...
It's a snapshot of the movie. It's definitely a snapshot of the movie. And you don't need more than one of them, folks. That's the only one you need in the shelf. It's like the giant claw piece that my dad got of him attacking the Empire State Building that Joe Lendotti sculpted. That's the only one you ever need. You're done. You got it captured in one snapshot there. All right.
We're still talking about the dinosaurs, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, but again, a half an hour or so into the movie was the first sighting of two real lizards fighting.
Yes.
Which it reminded me of the scene from the 1940 movie with Victor Mature, 1 million years BC. I understand that they put fins on the dinosaurs or on out. How do they get the two dinosaurs the two lizards to actually fight themselves? I mean, it's not something that you normally see in nature. And you wonder, is there a female off to the side and they're fighting for her, or did they put the pheromones on one and not on the other, and all of a sudden they can't stand each other? It's just really, it was almost like when you watch, it's almost like when you see some movies where they have cockfights, where the two males go at each other tooth and nail.
Yeah, but that's actual, if they're really putting two animals together, which is not allowed anymore ever on film, certain things will fight over certain things. They just gored them into fighting each other, Dad. That's the kind of garbagey stuff they used to do. But
again, they never. I mean, it's never. Yeah, but explained, you know
what? It also could be the same footage used over and over again. I mean, we've seen it before. They look very similar to the same iguanas that we've seen before. It's not like in Lost Continent where they have the alligator fighting the whatever the heck the other thing is.
Well, the first one, it was in 1 million years BC. But they've reused.
What's the alligator? It's an actual alligator that they put a fin on the back of. It's got to be not Lost Continent. It's not Lost World, which is that the
oh
one,
no, well the Lost World, the one, the remake of the Lost World in 1960.
It has
that one.
Not Lost Continent. The Lost Continent has this fire serpent where it's clearly a lizard coming out of like water. Red like gloopy stuff. So
the other one that we I can't remember the name of the movie right now. It's slipping on my tongue. It'll come to me.
So, but I'm saying, but I mean that's.
Oh no! It was the one we saw when dinosaurs ruled the world. When dinosaurs rule the world, there was they have a lizard, stomping through grass
It's to pad out the film because that's all. Was it Danforth's? Right, was it him?
Yeah,
doing that special effects. So, anyway, they put that stuff in again. It's also to pad out the film too. I got a feeling, again, there's no stop motion here. There's no even puppet-mation really. And
no,
stuff.
It doesn't. Yeah, as a matter of fact, when you go through the long credits, what they have is special photography was by Clifford Stein. There are the special effects are Fred Knott, Orrin Earnest, Jack Kavan, but there are no creature effects listed at all.
Right.
And then there's the optical effects, which is a gentleman by the name of Roswell Hoffman. Most of those are the helicopter with the snow and the ice, the background, and any reverse shots.
Yeah. So, if you're interested in seeing this movie, it's not. Even though this is a B movie, this is one of the ones that's not readily available everywhere. My dad actually purchased it's through the Vault series, right? Yeah,
right.
The Universal Vault series, which is like their print on demand. That goes for $13.99. I have Volume 2 of the Classic Sci-Fi Ultimate Collection for $9.96. That's what it's going for currently on Amazon. That comes with this movie, Land Unknown. Dr. Cyclops is another really good movie that, again, some people maybe have heard of but never seen. It comes with The Deadly Mantis, which is a really good movie, which is much in the vein of the giant monster movies of, like, Them and Tarantula and Black Scorpion and stuff like that. Then you have The Leech Woman, which is not in the vein of anything. And then, of course, Cult of the Cobra, which came a little later. And that's more, again, that's technically, I guess, a sci-fi movie, but it's kind of more of a, like, a cult kind of whatever. It's different. It certainly is the one that doesn't fit with the, like, it's like on Sesame Street. Which of these is not like the other?
Right.
You know, kind of thing like this. That's the one that's not like them. But it's not a bad movie if you like these kind of movies, but it's not certainly you're gonna be like, I gotta go run out and see this. So we have some emails. You have anything else about the movie you want to say?
Well, I just want to say that, you know, when you talk about the movie originally being an A-list, this thing was actually filmed in CinemaScope, which at that point was the latest and the greatest. You went to see the movies in CinemaScope so that you didn't have to watch it on the 16-inch square TV box.
Yeah.
And Jock Mahoney, who's Commander Roberts, he played Tarzan in a number of films at the same time. There was a series of Tarzan films that had him, and they had a few other guys. But he was Tarzan.
He was Tarzan.
No, but his Tarzan movies were pretty good. They weren't more muscle bound. I mean, he's a big strong guy, but he doesn't look like Hercules. His had more storyline to it than just, you know, flying through the trees and things like that.
But Tarzan is Johnny Weissmuller. I mean, everyone.
Oh, no.
And we're back, folks. Sorry about that technical difficulties. But this is not a Tarzan podcast, so we will talk about... is there anything else, Dad? We're about the movie?
No, that was it. Okay. Is it worth your time for 73 minutes? Yes.
Yeah.
Hopefully, if you Jason had mentioned about buying the DVD with the other three movies.
It's worth it. It's five movies for $10. It's worth buying. And they're all beautiful. And the copy you get with the Vault collection is the exact same print of the movie.
Right.
The exact same print. It's just, it's out of print. They took it out of print as a single run movie, and they do them singly. But you can still buy the 4-pack, and that was used to be a Best Buy exclusive, but now it's readily available.
Yep.
In fact, you can buy them both together and get 10 movies, and that's the Monolith Monsters and things like that. It's great. 10 movies, $21. So, all right, so let's get to a couple emails. We have a lot of emails. We're going to split them apart in a bunch of different shows. So if we didn't get to yours this week, or this month, then keep listening because we'll get to it. The first one says, forget Bridezilla. This is more like Groomalien. Any guess who that's from? Yes, my brother Luke. Jay, I Married a Monster from Outer Space remains one of the absolute best titles of any science fiction movie ever. To borrow the popular British phrase, it does what it says on the tin, as our heroine does indeed marry a monster from outer space. I remember this film being clever and holding my interest despite a lack of, as discussed, on-screen monsters from outer space through its running time, which is not always the case with some of these lesser-known movies. Of course, being conditioned in watching B-movies from childhood, I know how to modulate my expectations when going in, and ultimately, this film is enjoyable despite its flaws. All right, the plot itself is nothing special in a post-invasion of the Body Snatchers world. This having been said, I have always said if you are going to rip something off, rip off something good. And Body Snatchers is a classic. There's at least enough change in the formula here to justify its existence, mostly in the fact that all the aliens are men, making it the lead a female, which was pretty unusual for 1958. It's definitely watchable, fairly well shot and constructed, even if the acting is definitely subpar. One reason why I think I Married a Monster from Outer Space was caught on with critics in the modern sense is its distinct picture of the late 1950s suburban bliss. You get married, you move into a house in the suburbs, drive an American car, and have children. From a postmodern eye, the sense of horror inherent in not living that American dream, the woman can't have children. They can't have children is the proverbial low-hanging fruit from monographs of academic papers using film critique to bash post-war America and baby boomers. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that The Astronaut Wife with Charlize Theron and Johnny Depp was sort of a mashed-up remake of this film and Rosemary's Baby. And frankly, this film is better than The Astronaut's Wife. As far as other films with I Married a Monster shtick, there was I Married a Witch, which Femme Fatale Extraordinaire Veronica Lake, I Married a Communist, I Married a Spy, and I Married a Centerfold. One British film was released under the title The Man I Married Was Shot as I Married a Nazi. Yikes. Looking forward to Fiend Without a Face, which was another title which the Misfits used for a song, naturally. Luke. P.S. Bill! P.P.S. The Bill bit reminded me of the old stand-up routine about looking for your dead boyfriend in the in the basement using only the illuminating power of a candle. Bill!
Splort.
Yes, there's Luke. Luke's try. He definitely... Luke likes to use a lot of $3 words in there, too, which is great. But what Luke's talking about, that last bit, that's the old thing. You found your boyfriend's head in the toilet. You're in the basement looking for his torso. What are you looking for? You know, kind of thing. I think Luke's on point there, too. We hit a lot about I Married a Monster from Outer Space and how it really is not exactly like, the other movies of the day. I think, again, Luke's really correct there. People really latched onto it because it was so different in that it has a female lead. It definitely, pokes holes in the 1950s ideal lifestyle, American dream lifestyle. Whether you like that or not, I mean, you know, there's a whole decade came after it that tried to tear that all down anyway, called the 60s. You know, and then the 70s came and everyone wore polyester and did a lot of blow. Anyway, so, but the whole point was, I mean, Luke's really on point, a lot of that stuff. And again, it seems like a while ago because that film came out, you know, back around Valentine's Day, and we're just getting to it because, you know, things happen and we just didn't read stuff together. But, you know, thank you very much, Luke, for sending that in. You know, we've, Female Out of Face is, not Female Out of Face, excuse me, I Married a Monster from Outer Space is very iconic in that it has the great title that you know. It's very exploitative in the way it's done, and it was ripped off again and again by certain ideas of that. So, but the other one we have in with Luke's thing, I mean, it's just Luke was pretty, they hit it on the head there. We're going to read two, and again, I have some more for another time, but we'll read two. Here we go. So this one is from our good, a long listener and friend of the show and friend of actually the vault as well, Jack Bond. Jack writes, not much to say about The Fly that you haven't. Just a compliment about this, a complaint about the sequel. Not a compliment. No, it's not a compliment. A complaint about the sequels to the original or to the Cronenbergs, and none of them call itself Son of Fly. Which is exactly true. Jack goes on. Then your conversation turned to gimmicks, and you mentioned a movie with a built-in warning when to look away from the screen. I've seen that movie, and or one like it. The names Fear Flash and Horror Horn still stick in my mind. And I'm amazed how Googleable those phrases are. Nothing like turning on a horror movie that takes a few minutes at the beginning to demonstrate its emergency procedures to let us kids know we're in for something special, even though, you know, no, not really. Jack. So we talked about that. That was the it was like where it made the sound. He was to turn away because he was going to cut the body up or something. I don't remember what movie that is. It's just one of those kind of movies we had talked about. The gimmicks and stuff. The little William Castle kind of gimmicks.
Yeah, well,
that,
with the Tingler.
Yeah, what I'm saying. We mentioned it with the Tingler thing, but like it's funny. It's like there was. I don't remember what the movie
was. Was it 13 Ghosts?
13 Ghosts had the, we had to put the glasses on.
Right.
This Tingler was the shock in the seat.
Yeah.
And House on a Hill was something else. Like, I mean, there was always a gimmick with Castle, but there was some other movie where it said, when this sound happens, if you're turn away.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it was also Mr. Sardonicus with like, vote, do you live or die kind of thing. And everyone always voted die. And they only shot one end of the film. Like, we didn't shoot two, we only shot one. It's not like when they killed off Robin and they were like, well, we'll vote. Do you want to save him? They're like, no, let him die. You know, Jason Todd. That about does it for now. Thank you very much, Jack, for writing in. You know, always a great supporter of the show. We hope, you know, again, if you have anything to say to us, folks, send us an email. We'll gladly read it on the show, get to your feedback. I know sometimes we're not great about getting the feedback out as quick as possible because I let them kind of build up sometimes, but it happens. I do respond to every email myself personally and let you know what's, you know, I respond back to you, and then we read them out here, and then Dad and I will give you our take on it. So anything else here, Dad?
No, I'm through with today. I think even though this has been not one of our longer dissertations on a movie, I think we hit it pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, The Land Unknown is definitely a movie that was a staple of kind of like the old movies they used to show, like on like Super Series Saturday and things like that. Now it's kind of faded away, so you have to look for it. So up next, I don't think we could probably do a movie that's that much more different than this. Would be The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, which is the next thing Dad and I are going to cover. You know, the special effects are completely light years differently, even though the time frame is pretty much the same. So I know a lot of people have been asking about that movie. Dad and I wanted to get that out, you know, during the summertime when people are free, maybe taking road trips and they can listen to this in the car. Because, as you know, it's all kid-friendly because there's no bad words, just the silliness that involves whatever we're talking about. So, thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for downloading. Feedback is always welcome. Keep those cards and letters coming, and keep watching the skies.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yamgari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots, Bugs, Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?